Okay, so this is being recorded now. I've put everything that we're going to be doing today on my blog. Everything, including all the paintings and all the notes next to the paintings. So you can go through my blog and you'll find everything that we're doing today in my blog. And today's session is called, well, it's based around this core question: how can art deepen our understanding of literature? How can art deepen our understanding of literature? And I've created a blog question for you out of that, which is on my blog here. It's the first thing at the top of it. It says, choose any one of the paintings or artworks, because one of the ones we're going to see is not a painting, it's a sculpture right down the bottom of the gallery by an Aboriginal artist. Describe the painting or artwork of your choice, and the descriptions, you can start with the descriptions next to the paintings. I've taken an image of that. And say how this painting or artwork has expanded your understanding of literature. So that's all you're going to do. How it's a, you know, 200 words. I've got all the photos on here. Okay, so that's it. And we're going to go around a number of the different halls. First of all, I've selected one painting that hit me in the eyes there that connects to thematically to Alice Walker's everyday use, a story we've all read, thematically. So there's thematic connections between paintings and stories. There are biographical connections, like we're going to have a look at the painting of Henry Lawson, and we look briefly at The Loaded Dog and Sweeney, and of course, artists have painted authors, so that's a biographical connection. Then a lot of the things we've done have been stories. And story, the other word for story, is narrative. Now, for instance, Kate Chopin's Story of an Hour is a narrative. Now, a lot of paintings are narratives. Like Tom Roberts' painting of Jealousy is a narrative, which aligns very interestingly to Kate Chopin's Story of an Hour. Then there's some amazing narrative paintings in the 19th century in England. One of them's a huge painting, which is actually a celebration of English literature, because it's got the father of English literature, Geoffrey Chaucer, the poet, reading his great poem in the court of Edward III. It's a massive painting. So it's actually a painting about literature, but it's also a story, telling a story about Chaucer at the court of Edward III. Then there's an amazing painting about this man who was a real ruffian in his youth, got a real bad name for himself, and he met this amazing, gorgeous woman, and his life changed. He became filled with virtue and a sense of a new kind of... So the whole story is told there in the painting. Then we're going to do Shakespeare in a couple of weeks' time, and there are actually quite a few paintings here that were produced when Shakespeare was alive. There isn't a painting of him here, but you've seen paintings of him. But for instance, his poem, My Mistress' Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun. There are paintings here of women, passion, love. There are paintings of men who are dressed like the characters in Shakespeare's time. Paintings can be a real window onto the times in which literary texts were written. Like, if you've got no idea what the world of Shakespeare looks like, then wander around the Shakespeare Hall here and you get a real idea of what people looked like, what they dressed like, what their faces looked like, how they interacted, and so on. Then there's one painting by an Indigenous artist which is actually called In the Future, Art Will Not Be Boring. And it's a painting which links literature, text, poetry in a work of art. We're going to have a close look at that. Then there are quite a few paintings that pick up the landscape of David Malouf's Remembering Babylon. Painters who were painting at the time that David Malouf was writing his work. Russell Drysdale, Sidney Nolan, we're going to look at some of their work. Then we're going to look at links between art and concrete poetry. What's concrete poetry? Concrete poetry, you may remember early on, we looked at a poem that looked like a swan on the page. And we looked at another poem that was called The Knife, and it had this kind of cut down the middle. So, you know, poetry often is shaped on the page like an artwork. Well, there are paintings that shape themselves as words or try and shape themselves as music. So there's a kind of a interaction, a flowing interaction between art forms. And we'll see some of that here. Now, one of the things I really enjoyed doing with you was when we looked at poems that were really intense in their use of language and really wanted to make the subject jump out at us. Things like Galway Kinnell's Blackberry Eating, Squelch and Squinch. Their language is sort of pumping out at you, trying to turn the experience into a reality. Or there was, similarly, there was Judith Wright's Wattle Tree, reaching up to the sun, down the roots to the water. How the wattle tree was kind of filled with life and energy, how that artist, how she in words wanted to capture all that energy. Now there are painters who do that with paint. There's one beautiful one, Diana Schultz, called Breastfeeding, in which she depicts herself and her child breastfeeding. It's there in your face. Or there's a beautiful one, actually there's a video installation by a Japanese artist. It's called Gold, and it reminds me of the wattle tree. We'll go there as well. And then there's a wonderful early Australian 19th century painting called Spring Frost, which is just so powerful. The paint makes you want to kind of fall into the early morning sunrise. And then last but not least, we're going to go right down the bottom of the gallery where there's the Aboriginal section. Now what's interesting with this gallery is that the Aboriginal section has crept up the stairs, crept up three flights of escalators, and is now filling this central hall. This is where we're going to start, with one of these paintings in the central hall. But down in the Aboriginal section, they've got a wonderful exhibition of photographs by Mervyn Bishop, who's one of the best Indigenous photographers. It's also got a whole lot of Indigenous art by contemporary artists. And right in the middle is this sculpture, which is by Lynn Onus, who's one of the great Indigenous artists who really wants to make us think about the connections between black and white culture, like David Malouf does in literature. And he's got an amazing thing down there. I'm not going to tell you what it is until we get there. But we hopefully will get there before. I've got to keep my eye on the time. We have to get there before, I think, 4:30 we've got to try and finish, don't we? What do you reckon?
Yeah, I think so.
Finish around 4:30, and then the likes of Emma, who can belt back there in half an hour. Is that what you're going to do?
We were already saying, we'll get a taxi back later.
You could get a taxi back,
We can walk the next time.
It only takes like 15 minutes or about 20 minutes max.
Well, you're a fast walker.
Not really. Just know all the shortcuts.
Yeah,
not that long.
But, you know, if you finish about 5:40, 4:30, that will mean they get a little break.
Okay, so we're going to go, the first thing we're going to look at, the first thing here is Seven Sisters, which links to Alice Walker's everyday use. Let's have a look at it. So, Rosanna, we're going to sort of meander around. You'll just have to see us. Okay. Now I wanted to, there's one last thing that I forgot about. Come a bit closer while I'm talking you to feast your eyes on this painting. So,
which one? This one?
This one behind me. So I'm going to put you into pairs and you're going to do your assignment together in pairs. So this is a school group, okay? School group, not for you, okay? Unless you want to come and do the work. So you two are a pair, all right? You two are a pair. But since we don't have another pair, Song is with you two, and you are now a banana.
Gee, thanks, mate.
Not a pair. So, Song, come here.
Okay.
You three are a banana, okay? Unless somebody else comes, and then we'll have another two pairs. So you're the North Queenslanders, and the rest here are the Tasmanians. Pears grow in Tasmania, and bananas grow in Queensland. Got it. Very good. That's good. Now, the reason I've put you into pears and bananas is simple. When I've finished with you, if you've got time on your own, you go around in your groups to go and select which painting you're going to do your blog on. You can help each other decide. And you can help each other find where it is. Does that make sense? Okay. So behind me is this amazing painting by Seven Sisters, it's called. Well, actually, the Seven Sisters, there's a whole list of them there. I can't pronounce all their names. Chunkara Ken, Tari Young, etc. And this amazing painting, which kind of jumped out at me, it's just been put on the wall here, is a Seven Sisters story about family protecting and teaching each other. It tells of women being chased by a bad man, but being protected by their elder sister. They've also included the Chala honey ant, which refers to their country. And when they work together as a family, they're learning from each other and teaching each other. And they say, our family is strong because we teach all our young women this important Chukurpa. And Chukurpa is the force which unites Anangu with each other and with the landscape. So that's their tradition, everyday use. This is, for them, this is the art that gives them a connection with their country. And they say, we know this story so well because the Chukurpa lives in our minds. You know, so white people, when they see indigenous paintings, they don't know how to read it. But there's a whole narrative story here, and a narrative story that, to my mind, is an indigenous version of Alice Walker's everyday use. I mean, it's a very different story, but it's got that same underlying sense of wanting to connect with tradition, wanting to connect with land. Anybody got any questions at all about it?
I've got a question.
Josh, go.
Whereabouts does it, is it on the
head? It's on the top thing there, right, thematic links.
Okay.
So I've got in bold here, you can see on the list that I've given you.
I see what this is, there it is.
Yeah, the bold is the kind of link that I'm making between the artwork and literature, and this is a thematic link.
Okay.
That makes sense, Adelaide?
Yes, the theme.
Yeah.
So it's going in order, right?
It's going in order. That's, we're going to go in order, yeah.
It's a year, it's a person.
It is beautiful. It's amazingly colourful and just rich and vibrates with energy.
I always loved Aboriginal art ever since I was little.
Fantastic. Maybe you've got some in your blood.
Maybe.
It's possible.
You know, my dad's real grandmother is Maori.
Okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, so.
Well, you've got a connection there with the indigenous world.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
That's what it's like, that's what it's like.
Okay, folks.
We're going. So you'll be discussed with our partner every painting or one that we particularly...
Well, when we've finished, you can decide with your partner which one you want to do. That's
what we do. We do both vlogs on the same one.
No, you're not doing this. You don't have to do the same. You don't have to do the same painting in your team.
Help each other take notes.
Help each other take notes. That's right. Just to facilitate each other's.
Yeah.
So you're not alone. Ronan's not alone in the gallery. He's got Rima to help him.
Okay.
And Rima's got Ronan to help him. Fantastic. Yeah, great. Rima, Nigel, Adelaide. So we've moved from the Grand Hall. We've moved from the Grand Hall into the 19th century Australian section. Like, if you come back to this gallery, you'll find that the artwork is organized by country and also by historical period. So the 19th century begins in the early colonial down there, and here we're sort of in the later 19th century. And up there is my best friend Henry Lawson, 1900. And when I bring my Australian literature students in here, we all have to go like this. Henry Lawson. I'm not going to ask you to do it because you're not Australian literature students, so you're lucky. But in 1900, he was at the peak of his career. He'd just got a contract to go to London. He'd published his book of stories, and he was, you know, a proud man. He's got his pipe in his hand. He'd really made it. It was a downhill road from him from then, sadly. He got very much into alcoholism, ended up in Darlinghurst jail, and died, you know, a very, very tragic man. And, you know, personal reasons, but also he tended to blame the government and lack of funding for the arts and so on.
Which is partly the case.
But certainly, you know, he's the great icon of Australian literature for the 19th century.
Nothing else has much changed, mate.
That's right, that's right. So if we come over here...
But it really was alcohol, did it?
Well, yeah, but what triggers alcohol? These things are complex, aren't they?
Jealous women.
Now, this one here is Tom Roberts' Jealousy. And just get the notes up for this one.
So you've got the placards with the blog, have you?
I've got this. Everything that's there is on the blog.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
So it says here that this was painted in 1889. And it was one of the major studio paintings produced by Tom Roberts. Now, Tom Roberts was one of the great late 19th century Australian artists. He produced some fantastic, iconic paintings. We'll go past a few of them in a moment. Things like Bailed Up about the Bush Rangers, Sheep Shearers, one is called Golden Fleece. You know, he's around about in the 1890s, the Australian artists were finding Australian subjects to show that they were different from England. But this is a painting here which is a real narrative painting, and triggered my mind that it's a bit like Story of an Hour. It's about jealousy. It was produced by Tom Roberts in the years when he came back to Melbourne from being in Europe in 1885. It was first exhibited with a title taken from a line from Shakespeare's play Othello, and the line was, "One not easily jealous, but being wrought, perplexed in the extreme." So, you know, a person not easily jealous, but once they get jealous, can't stop the jealousy. And it says that Jealousy was something of a promotional painting which showcased his studio skills and drew upon the popularity of 1880s narrative painting. See, in the 1880s, before the films and television, people used to come in here with their picnic baskets and sit down and say, "What the hell's going on in that?" And they'd invent the story. Why is she so tense when she's listening to this conversation that's happening over here? What is that conversation that's happening over there?
I don't feel that she's that tense.
Look at her face.
Oh my God.
It says she's recoiling in horror. She's recoiling in horror as she listens to the flirting couple by the doorway.
Oh yeah, she is, sorry.
The comment made there is the contrived emotional expression combined with the ambient light source from the doorway enhance the dramatic outcome. So, you know, just like in Kate Chopin's story, you get paragraphs that suggest the sounds of the birds outside and her feeling of yearning for a new life, but then the horror of her husband returning, it's done through words. So in art and in painting, artists achieve the same emotional effects through light and shade, through color, through expression, through gesture. So paintings also have their way of carrying and capturing emotion and feelings. There's a whole language of painting that, you know, is similar to that of the language of literature. Okay, so let's come round this way. We're going to go and have a little look at the world of Shakespeare. We're going to skip one for the moment. We're going to skip down to Shakespeare.
Down in here, the smallest room.
The smallest room here. You know about it, do you?
I've come here all the time, mate.
Right. This is usually filled with Shakespeare here too, but they've got another exhibition.
Who's this? Lord Leighton.
Now we're skipping down to Jacques Blanchard. This one here. That's the one.
This one?
Yeah. So in this room, every painting in this room was produced when Shakespeare was around. Some of them before he was born, some of them during his lifetime, and some of them immediately afterwards. But in this room, you get a real taste of what the world was like when Shakespeare was alive and when he was writing. And I've got on our sheets here the connection between this painting and My Mistress' Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun. Well, in Shakespeare's time, as in our time, sexuality was a very topical subject. And this painting is actually a mythological painting about the god of war, Mars, discovering this woman, the Vestal Virgin, discovered asleep in a wood. And the consequence of this discovery was the birth of the twins Romulus and Remus, who were the founders of Rome. And the painting is one of the finest surviving examples of an artist famous in his day as the French Titian. Titian was one of the great Italian Renaissance artists, yeah. And it's a very sensuous painting, and you'll find that Shakespeare in his language is extremely sensuous. Mistress Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun's got that sensuosity in it, but when we come to look at The Merchant of Venice, Shakespeare loves language that captures the physical sensuality of the world around him. And that painting, I've actually used that painting to illustrate things about Shakespeare's Midsummer Night's Dream, when I sometimes do that with my students also. It's not coming from Midsummer Night's Dream, it's actually coming from the foundation of Rome, you know, the birth of Romulus and Remus, who gave the beginnings of Rome. But in its texture and its subject matter, it's very like the scene out of Midsummer Night's Dream, very much like that. So the other Shakespeare paintings that I've picked in here, one in the corner over here, this gentleman with a very sophisticated looking lace collar. He is called, it's Portrait of a Man, and it's by Frans Bourbos. And let me just tell you about him. Everything that I'm telling you here, you can look up for yourselves afterwards, because I've put it all onto the blog. So this man, this painting was done in around 1610, so that's exactly at the time that Shakespeare was writing The Merchant of Venice and his major plays. So Shakespeare would have seen someone who looked just like that walking the streets of London, and in his descriptions of characters, someone like that would have certainly been in his mind. This is a very fashion-conscious gentleman, and probably aristocratic, like the Merchant of Venice himself. A clue might have been given by the medallion hanging at his side. There's a little medallion hanging down here on his side. But this appears to have been defaced and repainted. So once you might have been able to see something about this man, but it's been changed. Bourbos, the artist, was a highly successful court portrait painter. In those days, you earned your money as an artist by painting the wealthy people in court. And he worked for the Gonzaga court in Italy, in Mantua, before settling in Paris in 1609. So Bourbos would probably have heard about Shakespeare's successes, which were happening over in England at that time. And from the costume and his hairstyle, this work seems likely to date from his time in Paris. So it's just a window on that world. That's the importance of this art. When I do Shakespeare with students at ACU, and Nigel behind there will tell you because I've done it with him, I bring the students down here, we look at the Shakespearean art to kind of soak them in the atmosphere as much as possible. And then we also go up into the State Library, where there is the Shakespeare Room. Shakespeare was a very popular dramatist in Sydney in the 1900s. In fact, the first play by Shakespeare that was ever put on was in 1802, and it was Henry IV, Part 1, which is a play about rebellion against authority. And it was put on by a convict cast. Fantastic that happened. And in the State Library, there's a Shakespeare Room, which is decked out just like it would have been in his time. And it's got a chair in the corner made out of the mulberry tree that was in his garden. I visited Shakespeare's house. It's all gone. The only thing that's left is bits of his garden. Here is another portrait worth drawing attention to for the point of view of Shakespeare. This is the self-portrait of Peter Paul Rubens. And Peter Paul Rubens would have to be the Dutch equivalent of Shakespeare in the world of art.
Oh, it's a beautiful painting, isn't it?
Peter Paul Rubens was perhaps the world's most successful artist back at that time, like Shakespeare in the world of theatre. This is one of two self-portraits painted by Rubens in 1623, shortly before Shakespeare's death. This version was painted for his friend, a French scholar, and the artist is showing himself in full court dress. This is the image of a man who began life as a courtier and whose skill and learning earned him privileged access to the kings and queens of Europe. When this painting was engraved in 1630, this became the official image of Europe's most successful painter. So, Europe's most successful painter next to Europe's most successful dramatist, William Shakespeare, at that time, definitely. So this is the 15th and 16th century room. One of the great things about being an art gallery is that you can time travel. You know, sit in a little machine and suddenly you're in the 19th century. And suddenly you're back in the 15th century. So just put on your time travel suits now. We're now going to go into the 19th century. 1800s, let's go! Let's go! Right up your street, Adelaide. Closer, folks. So this room. Just have a look around the room. This is like Victorian England and like a Victorian living room. They loved lots of things crowding their space, and particularly the Victorians loved narratives. They loved narrative paintings, storytelling paintings, because it was, as I said, it was before film and television, and they wanted paintings to really tell them a story. Now, this wonderful painting here was done in the middle of the 19th century, 1847 to 1851. It took him 4 years to paint this painting. He would have had to have a ladder to get up to paint the top sections. And it's a painting that embodies a love of literature. Literature and art here go together. Because this is a painting of the father of English literature, Geoffrey Chaucer, who's most famous for his book called The Canterbury Tales, which tells stories about all the people in the late 1400s in England who went on pilgrimage from London to Canterbury and back. And this painting is, you might have to stand where you're getting less reflection.
You have to go one side to the other.
That's right. It's a celebration of English literature, but also of English language. Chaucer is here reading
from the text, from the Canterbury Tales, to his king. And the importance about this king, Edward III, Edward III was a king who really championed the English language over the French. You know, England had been, for decades, had been ruled by France. And Edward III decided that he wanted the English language to be the dominant language in English, and he really supported Chaucer writing the Canterbury Tales in English. And this was a breakthrough, because English literature prior to that time had been Anglo-Saxon literature, hadn't really got off the ground. So it was partly Edward III who promoted Shakespeare. Now that's about Shakespeare back in the 13th century. But this painting is painted in the 19th century, and that's an interesting story in itself. The artist, Ford Madox Brown, he was part of a group of artists, and there are other artists in his group on this wall, who called themselves the Pre-Raphaelites. What's Pre-Raphaelites? Pre-Raphaelite, Raphael was an Italian artist who lived way back at the early Renaissance, and Ford Madox Brown and his colleagues, they were so sick to death of the British Industrial Revolution, the smoke-filled cities, the abuse of poverty-stricken people. England was in a mess economically. I mean, a lot of people were making a lot of money, but it was at the expense of the working class. And a lot of artists, writers, as well as painters, wanted to find some kind of solution to the problems in England. You had people like Charles Dickens, who kind of tackled the problem head on and wrote about the sordid living conditions and the suffering that people had to go through. And there's an artist up here, it's called The Widower, and that artist there is actually a friend of Charles Dickens. You can read down below there that Charles Dickens used him as an illustrator. That artist is kind of dealing with the problem by looking at the harsh difficulties of the time. Ford Madox Brown and his colleagues, they wanted to go back into a time when life was colourful, joyous, alive, beautiful. So that's part of the impulse behind a painting like this. It's kind of dealing with reality by creating a new reality, by entering a different sort of reality, through creating a narrative that celebrates all these characters here. They're all carrying on their own lives. It's a beautiful painting to bring children here and try to work out what they're saying to each other. What do you reckon these two are saying to each other here? What speech bubble would you put in there, Ronan? That's something very good. And Patricia, what speech bubble would you put into this mouth here?
Mouth of a fool, support tissue.
They are, that's absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
So can you say that he made this scene up?
He made this scene up.
From his mind.
That's right, from his mind. He wasn't there at the time.
Because he didn't want to have to live in that either.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. Well done. Nicely put. And so they loved colour, they loved movement, they loved gesture, all that kind of thing. So this is a painting that shows not only narrative, but it shows connection with literature, it shows valuation of the English language, and it also tells us a lot about England in the 19th century and what artists were trying to do with that problem. There's a lot of things going on in a painting. If we turn around over here... Now this is a painting specially for Adelaide, rather.
Yeah, he's got a beautiful house in London.
He has.
Leighton House.
He has.
Yeah, and it's all arabesque.
That's right, that's right.
And unfortunately, the English lost Flame in June. It's in an art gallery in Puerto Rico or some strange place like that.
Now, we're talking about paintings that are narratives. Narratives. You know, we started off talking about Kate Chopin's Story of an Hour. But we've read lots of stories. We've read Tim Winton. We're now reading Remembering Babylon. Stories have narratives in them. Do paintings have narratives? Well, the Chaucer painting's got a long and complex narrative. You could probably write a book to complete that painting here. The narrative of this painting, it's again very 19th century. It's attuning itself to the emotional, sensual, ethical prejudices of the 19th century, and it's mixed up with sensuality and morality. A whole lot of things you could read about this painting and the way it reflects 19th century culture. The story about it helps us a little bit. It was done by Frederick Leighton, and Adelaide tells us. Tell us about the house in London, Adelaide.
Oh, he has a beautiful house called Leighton House, and it's full of arabesque tiles, and oh, it's just stunning.
It's like under a Roman bath.
Huh?
Inside's like a Roman bath.
It is, yeah, be like that. Yeah.
All mosaic and
beautiful
stuff.
Beautiful tiles, you know, Persian tiles and ceramics and stuff.
And Frederick Leighton was an incredibly popular and successful painter.
And he was the head of the Art Institute.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. He would have been, he would have earned megabucks to sell a painting like this. This painting is based on mythology. It's called Simon, spelt with a C, and Iphigenia, and it was produced in 1884. And we're told that the subject is from the Italian Renaissance storyteller's Decameron, a book about love. And there was a man called Galesus. He was a handsome son of a noble Cypriot. But he was so uncouth and uneducated in his ways that he was known as Simon, which meant brute. That was in his late teens. He would have probably ended up in jail. That's him here. That's him here. We haven't got to him yet. He's a changed person now. One afternoon, and this is the story, one afternoon he came across a girl, Iphigenia, asleep with her slaves, must be one of her slaves over here, in a meadow. And he became so transfixed by her beauty, his love was so strong that he decided to abandon his boorish ways, and he wanted then to acquire the accomplishments fitting to the nobility of his station in life. And what do you think is symbolized by the sun rising over the water there?
New
awakening, the moral awakening of this young man. And so
it's almost like his insides have transformed.
That's right. Inside,
he's become handsome.
He has, absolutely. And her form is irradiated with light, sense of light.
But the angel of light shines under her.
That's right.
And the dog?
And the dog. And the dog.
Faith or something.
It might be. You see, that's it. It's interesting. Within a painting like this, just as in a story, you can read the symbolism of every detail in there. Why did the artist put it there? What's the purpose of that? So Simon the Brute is going to become true to his own nobility, and he's going to be a changed person now. He's shocked into a new consciousness, a new morality.
All through love.
All through love. That's it. Love is the greatest.
And sight disappears. Love is the greatest.
Love is the greatest. You finish it for me, Adelaide.
I don't know, the thing that transforms your
life.
It
does, transforms your life. Now, having said all that, I don't want to spoil the impression for you. But people say about this, well, that's true. Simon has been changed. But what has changed him? This woman is very sensual in her diaphanous gowns lying there. You know, there's a, well, it's love, but there's a certain, there's no lack of eros there. There's eros there as well. And the Victorians loved this kind of blend between morality and eros. Okay, are we going to move on? Yes, we're going to move on. Let's go. So now, folks, we're going to time travel from the mid-19th century to the late 20th century in Australia. An Indigenous artist is going to confront us with questions about the relationship between literature and painting. Let's go. Yes.
Painting called of Edward.
Yep, Edward III, yep.
So that is that the guy that's standing there, is that Edward III?
No, that's Chaucer talking, and it's the man sitting on the throne who's Edward III, the king of the throne.
So he's measuring himself being there, talking to
him. Yep. He's a sculptor as well. Yeah.
So he measured himself.
That one, I know that one. That's a good story. It's another story, it's a great story.
I don't know.
They got their ankles tendons cut. That's right.
They got stretched out.
That's right.
No. They got stretched out for the
cover.
Exactly, exactly. I can see that painting's fired your imagination. That would be the one that you would do your blog on, I would think.
Either that or the Seven Sisters.
Okay, fantastic. I mean, you can copy the photos from my blog site and put them into your blog. So, are we all here? Okay, so this is a great painting from the point of view of mangoes are. We've talked about the way that poetry uses a repetition a lot, haven't we? Now, you ask yourself, is this a painting or is it a poem? This is a kind of a hybrid between literature and painting. And it's by an Indigenous artist who is called Gordon Bennett. And it was done in 2014. No, it wasn't. He died in 2014. It was done in 1999. And...
well, so after Baccarat...
Basquiat.
Yeah, that guy.
Basquiat.
Yeah, the Jamaican man.
I'll read you what it says here. This will give us a little... well, but before I read it to you, what do you notice there in terms of words on there? What sort of things do you notice?
First notice the police line, do not cross. I notice it's the art police, so maybe it's that invisible benchmark like of contemporary art, you know what I mean? Like,
what's right and what's wrong? Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
And what's accepted, you know?
And could that be the dead body of a person? And that's why.
What sort of person?
Looks like an Aboriginal.
Sure. Looks like an Aboriginal. That's
right.
What
he's hanging off.
That's right. What is he hanging off?
A cross.
That's right.
From the missionaries.
So this is
that interpret this. So colonisation. You know what I mean? They're called apes. You know what I mean? Like, you know, it's the grunt grunt, but the grunt grunt is a white man with the. I know the name of the thing.
Halo?
No, it's not a halo. It's
the Wanjina man, this here?
Wanjina.
Yep.
It's the Wanjina on it. So it's a white man just pretending to be an ape. It's the Wanjina on it. You know, he's got the sea anchor and the baits on it. So he's like a modern day white supremacist, or you could say like Anglo-Saxon dropkick.
And so you could see here perhaps some of the language used against Jemmy Fairley, couldn't you? The language used against Jemmy Fairley here by there's a few there.
A couple actually. Why is the cross uneven? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's, you know how, for example, that line there, it's much smaller at the end and much thicker at the top.
It doesn't mean anything. There's no intent on that. It's just the fact that he's hanging off the missionary cross.
Okay.
Now there is a lot of European artists in the mid-1950s who were using Aboriginal themes in their artwork.
Which is?
And the question was this legitimate or not? Or what was the motivation for that? That was the question. You know, was Margaret Preston, in her passionate interest in Indigenous art, when she incorporated Indigenous ways of looking at things into her art, she thought that she was trying to make a connection with the Indigenous world, but was she appropriating it for her own purposes?
This appropriating is the question. It for her own purpose.
This is these are important questions that this painting raises. Now let me
appropriate it for her own purpose, full stop.
Let me read to you what
without permission you can't go and paint things like I can't go and paint ones. No, you can't. Yeah. You're not from that country. You just can't paint that.
So I'm going to read to you what the text over here says. Gordon Bennett was an Australian artist of Indigenous and Scottish ancestry. who challenged fixed constructions of race and identity in his work. Gordon Bennett notes in his painting, or this painting is called Notes to Basquiat, and Adelaide has told it that this Basquiat is an American-Jamaican artist. Yes. Do you know anything about Basquiat, Adelaide?
Oh, did he die of a drug overdose very young?
He might have, I'm not sure.
His artist was so much.
Yeah.
It was sort of like graffiti.
Okay,
and stuff, yeah.
Okay.
That's Basquiat, like that stuff that is Basquiat. Like
okay.
He was there. Jamaican or something. Without he was black. No, Haitian or something like
yeah,
that.
Something like that. So Bennett's painting, which is called Notes to Basquiat, and then part of the title is also In the Future Art Will Not Be Boring. That's part of the title of this, In the Future Art Will Not Be Boring. It's from a series of works that began in 1998 as a dialogue between him and Jean-Michel Basquiat,
yeah.
American artist.
Yeah.
Bennett had admired Basquiat since art school, just like you, Josh, have admired Indigenous art since your primary days, and Bennett identified parallels in their life and careers as black artists whose ethnicity often overshadowed their practice. Now, to the left is an abstract composition based on a drawing by Malevich, and trapped within it is a figure adapted from Margaret Preston's cartoonish depictions of Aboriginal people. Margaret Preston, whose work is being presented upstairs in a special exhibition, is a celebrated Australian modernist who has been acclaimed for the domestic usage of Indigenous art and design during the 1920s and 30s in what nowadays can be seen as a culturally insensitive practice. This artist's appropriation and juxtaposition is a metaphor for a little known or understood form of subjugation of Indigenous culture within the history of modernism, drawing attention to a local instance of it in Australian art. That's quite a mouthful, but it gives a little bit more context and understanding to what's going on here. So look out for Gordon Bennett's work. And the work we're going to see, the last work we're going to see downstairs by Lynn Onus, similar in its bringing together of European and Indigenous icons, but very, very different, as you'll see. Okay, so now we're going to have a look at some work that picks up David Loof's Remembering Babylon. Follow me around here. Come and have a look at Jemmy Fairley, or not. Now, these three paintings here are by Russell Drysdale, and he did all the paintings on this wall here. Russell Drysdale was a white European origin artist, but he had a great deal of feeling for Indigenous culture. He's probably one of the greatest artists in the 20th century to bring Indigenous culture into prominence for European eyes. Whether we can say about him what was said about Margaret Preston through Gordon Bennett's painting is a question mark. My reading of Russell Drysdale is that he's always very sympathetic. That's my reading. Like, this is a new painting by him called Aboriginal Stockman. That's the one I've put up on my blog. I haven't put these two up, but these two, Aboriginal families dressed in European clothes, To me, he's... Well, what's your thought about what kind of impression he's giving about these indigenous people? Can you read from these paintings the artist's feelings towards these people? Give us your thoughts.
I thought he actually went out there and painted exactly what he saw.
That's right, he did. Yeah. But you can paint exactly what you see, but you can still express your feeling about it. It's not, as it were, feeling neutral.
Yeah.
I feel like poor,
forced assimilation. It's forced assimilation for missionaries.
They have no choice,
mate, because the town has taken all the water. They built buildings on their on their sacred sites and did everything without permission. And they had to go out where there was no water, no food. And then the missionary said, "You can't talk in cane if you want to come to the town." There's a lot of stuff that happened back in those days.
So is it presented sympathetically, that story?
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it is. Yeah. And I think
it's one of them smiling.
But they look a bit like the wind's being knocked out of this sail.
Yeah, yeah. But they're still a cohesive family group.
Yeah.
They're still a group.
I feel like in America back then,
American Indians.
They weren't allowed to sit in the front of the bus. They always had to sit in the back of the bus. Yep. The same as in Australia. Pretty much anywhere you go, really.
Legally, legally. They used to be allowed to shoot a black man if they were found on the property. In 1989, down at the back of Burke, Aboriginal was found on a farmer's property and he shot him and he got away with it in court because the law had never been changed.
Okay, yeah. So the world of
1989, legally shot him.
Russell Drysdale's depiction of Aboriginals, to my way of thinking, is
very sympathetic.
Sympathetic, and sympathetic in the way that David Maloof is sympathetic, although David Maloof is not representing an Indigenous person, but somebody who's come from the Indigenous world. And as Neil was saying to me earlier, we don't even hear Jemmy Fairley speak, except a couple of times. So his presence is kind of communicated non-verbally in the book. So let's have a look at the landscapes from...
So what would you say about... Have you got anything else to say about
nothing else to say about that one. No, mm-hmm. Nothing else. That covers it.
So this is symbolising Jemmy Fairley. It's not actually Jemmy Fairley.
It's not actually Jemmy Fairley. Yeah, it's not actually.
Okay,
right.
But
this is another painting by Russell Drysdale. I haven't got this on my blog, but it's an interesting painting. It's done from the landscape out near Broken Hill. It's called The Walls of China. And Russell Drysdale, very unlike most European artists, has decided to paint just this misshapen kind of tree trunk, but he presents it in indigenous colours, the landscape of the earth, and he makes this into a kind of a powerful, mysterious symbol of the interior. And artists in the 1950s, like Drysdale, like Nolan, like Boyd, and then like Patrick White and David Maloof, were trying to get us to kind of see and experience the Australian landscape in a new way. And so this, this is a very important painting in that direction. Let's go around the corner and have a look at Cindy Nolan. Okay, so we're looking at this one here called Central Australia, 1950.
Pinnacles.
And, the interior of this continent, by European settlers and by European explorers to begin with, was seen to be a totally dead land, meaningless land, and all they wanted to do was either knock it down or dig it up for gold and what have you. It took an artist like Sidney Nolan and other artists like Fred Williams to gradually change our relationship to the landscape, and you might even say, to begin to give us an appreciation and affection for the landscape that Indigenous people might have had. And what this note says here, it says in 1949, Nolan travelled with his wife Cynthia and daughter Jinx through Central Australia. His encounters with the dramatic landscape of the centre had a profound impact on him. In this painting, Central Australia, Nolan paints the exhilaration of expanse and space. He's so excited by it. Envisaged from an aerial vantage point, Nolan painted the primeval formations and saturated colours of land and sky with a precision that makes it appear dreamlike. In doing so, he enhanced the mystery of the interior, inscribing it with a modern sense of the sublime. Nolan exhibited this Central Australia series to high acclaim at the David Jones Gallery in 1950, and the critic James Gleeson referred to the exhibition as one of the most important events in the history of Australian art. The seemingly infinite lunar-type formations of the land were a revelation and redefined white Australians' perceptions of the nation's landscape. And the painting next to it, which is Ant Hills in the Northern Territory, is also by Sidney Nolan and does something similar with the coarse, harsh bushland. And, you know, if I'm thinking of David Malouf's description of Jock McIver walking through a paddock, seeing grass in a new way with its beads of light and its beetle, there's something about David Malouf's intensity of seeing that you find also in Sidney Nolan's paintings.
So different to those earlier.
So different.
Like completely different.
Absolutely. We've sort of grown up to...
Earlier bands showed your paintings of the Australian bushland and the Australian formations, but not the interior. It only shows you the mountains and, you know, where they're basically just, you know...
Okay. So follow me around this way. We're now going to... Oh, thank you, Nigel. Thanks a lot. That's great. Okay, we're now on to, we're skipping around a little bit, we're now on to links between art and concrete poetry on the sheet. You got your sheet there? I'm working down this sheet step by step. Now, the reason that we looked briefly at concrete poetry in our class, we looked at the poem that shaped like a swan on the page and the poem that looked like a cut of a knife through a poem. What I was trying to do there when we were looking at that was to try and make you aware that when people write poetry, the shape on the page is part of the meaning. We're not just looking at words isolatedly, we're looking at words as they're shaped. And in a way, this applies to all literature. Like in David Malouf's story, as Neil's pointed out today, you get these very short, punchy sentences, and you get these long sentences that seem to kind of be filled with all sorts of things happening. So literary language, unlike the language of the newspaper or the history book, literary language, whether it's poetry or prose, is shaped. It's got texture. It shifts and moves.
Puts you there.
Puts you there. Now, this painting here was done by an Australian artist, Reutemeister, just after the First World War. And Reutemeister was keen to try and find ways of curing soldiers who had been mentally damaged by shell shock.
Yeah, it's the hospital, right?
A hospital.
It was put in a hospital originally.
Put in a hospital originally, and he tried to get people to work with paint and music. And he tried to get people to see the links between paint and music. Now you can see that this is an abstract painting, but it's got rhythm in it. It's got movement in it, just like music's got movement in it. And if you look at the title here, it's called Rhythmic Composition in Yellow, Green, Minor. Any musicians in the room?
Yeah.
What does minor usually refer to?
The lower key?
A key in music. It's a key. Like you've got major key, you've got minor key. So minor is...
Well, it's a higher key, really.
Minor is... Oh, it's a sad key. Whoa, that's a minor key. This is a happy one. Ah, that's a happy key. That's a major key. So minor is sad, but it's a musical term. So this painting is called... is given a title like music. So just like the concrete poem... that's shaped like a swan is words that are visually shaped. So this is a painting that's shaped like sound. So showing you that the kind of overlap between different art forms, and in this case, the overlap is being used by Roy de Maistre as an aid to help people come to their senses, to come aligned again, because they've been shocked out of their senses by horror on the battlefield. So what does this note say here? How does it help us? It says, Roy de Maistre in 1918 collaborated with fellow artist Roland Wakelin in exploring the relationships between art and music. Their experiments produced Australia's first abstract paintings, characterized by high key color, large areas of flat paint, and simplified forms. And just like when in literature I can talk about characterized by exclamations, short sentences, long wielding rhythmic sentences, so in art you can talk about the actual bits and pieces of paintings, just like this talks here, large areas of flat paint, simplified forms. The works received critical acclaim by modernist developments, but they were derided or hated by the conservative establishment. Who dares to produce a painting like that to put on the wall? That's not a painting, that's rubbish. Any child can come along and smear green and yellow paint and turn it... not a painting for me. Give me Peter Paul Rubens any day. So that's how the conservative establishment would have reacted to a painting like this. This painting exemplified de Maistre's theory of colour harmonisation based on analogies between colours of the spectrum and notes of the musical scale. It is also aligned with de Maistre's, the artist's, search for spiritual meaning through abstraction, akin to other artists such as the Russian Kandinsky, who wrote a book called The Spiritual Through Art. They were interested in the ideas of the Theosophy and Anthroposophy movements. They were interested in spiritualism and the occult through art and made painting and music. Okay, right, follow me. We haven't got far to go here. There's something just around the corner.
The early morning street.
Now, believe it or not, this was done 1 year after the painting we just looked at. So, you know, in
by a conservative.
Very conservative. Very conservative. God, you're on the ball today, Neil. You are on the ball. 1919. Now, why I've put this one here, I've put it here, look, for intensity. The second last item on our sheet, links between the intensity of the language in poetry and the intensity of paint on the canvas. Now, there are very different many ways of creating intensity, as you'll see. There's no one way of creating intensity. So how is intensity, like I'm comparing this to Judith Wright's The Wattle Tree, which we've all studied.
He's piled his paint up to make it almost 3D, and then it blends out at the back, it goes flat again.
Well, Neil's made some wonderful observations there, the way the paint,
the paint is lifted up,
the texture of the paint, like the texture of words.
Don't get too close, guys.
Words create textures just as paint create textures. And look at the way the sunlight is coming, filtering through the fog.
And clustering the animals together.
They get milked.
And what's it catching here? What's the light catching over here, Ronan? What's the light catching here?
It's the cows.
No, look closer. Where my fingers are.
Oh, the light's catching the cherry blossoms.
Yes, they're catching the cherry blossoms. So the cherry blossoms are being sparkling to life with the light coming through it. So this artist is getting intensity through light and light's impact on surfaces and textures.
Saturation of the colour.
It's very good. Very good. The saturation of the colours at the time of day. Very good.
Yes.
You can write an essay with these students. They'd love your help.
I just was going to ask you,
this is a group of university students. No.
Can I join just to leave if I listen?
Yeah, that's fine. That's fine. Not a problem.
You're a tour guide.
I am a teacher, not a tour guide. Yeah.
Thank you. That'd be nice if I could just listen.
Okay. So, a good example of the way that intensity of paint, texture, saturation, light, all this can create something that's akin to Galway Kinnell's blackberry eating, Judith Wright's the wattle tree. But there's more along this line. Let's come down, let's go and have a little ride on the escalator. I got one in my pocket thanks to my other mentor, Nigel. Ooh. Take a seat, folks.
That's a meditation, isn't it?
Sit, but face that way.
Polarization.
So I was very impressed when I saw this as an example of contemporary video art, which is through video techniques, is attempting to also create intensity of expression in an art form, not in paint on a canvas, but through videoing flowers. It's actually called Flower and People Gold, and it reminded me very much of Judith Wright's The Wattle Tree.
Growing, it just continually grows with you, watch it.
Let me read to you what it says here. Now, I didn't take a picture of this. There isn't a picture available. So if you wanted to take a picture of this and talk about it, you'd have to take your own picture. Flowers and People Gold by Tokyo-based collective Team Lab gives the impression of a traditional gilded floral Japanese screen, but emits rather than reflects light. The panels appear to be covered with squares of gold leaf, against which vibrant flowers bloom and fade, petals scatter, and budding begins again in response to the proximity of viewers. So if you go closer to it, you'll actually see the whole thing change. This representation of the endless cycle of life was created using a real-time computer algorithm and sensors, ensuring that flowers and people is never the same twice.
Sorry, what wasn't twice?
It's never the same twice.
Really?
Yeah, never the same twice. Nothing is repeated on there. I'm going to take a video of it and put this up on my blog for you so you can.
There we go, and that will start to grow again.
Here it comes again.
Yeah, it starts.
Good question.
There's a new one coming.
What's that? It's using 3D animation, I think.
Yeah.
It's
different from
4D. No, 3D, because it's not
sprite. So it's the flowers are dying and then they regrow.
It's like animation. Have your own what?
Your
on your own? Well, if you can spend years.
All right, we better copy some data to get this in the work, won't we?
I reckon.
I've done it in pixels, so we're taking.
Is it animation?
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, look at that. Yeah. I've been sitting here for hours.
I had a friend of mine from high school.
Yep.
He did a lot of that type of work. But what he was a multimedia person, and what he did was instead of doing it like that, he used to have holograms.
Yep.
Used to create holograms or something similar like this, but you could actually play with those holograms and. You know, put your hands up and move things around and use puzzles and stuff like that.
Okay.
As holograms. So, yeah.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
Oh, look at that.
It's like a sort of a sophisticated kaleidoscope.
Yeah. It was something similar, but you could play with it. Apparently.
Yeah, yeah. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So who has done this?
This is done by a Japanese collective. Yeah. This is in the Asian gallery here.
I know. Exactly.
And well, I've put it up onto the blog. I've got the text over there, yeah.
Is it the actual video on the blog?
I've got a video of it, yeah.
Hey, also,
once you have one copy of this, can you produce more, or individually you have to make them? I don't know how it works.
What this thing,
can it be, like, is it like video?
It's a video, but no, it's not a video. It's done by computerized mathematical formula.
So you cannot take copies of it.
No, you can't. I mean, I've taken a copy of what I've seen, but that will never be repeated.
It's amazing.
What I was going to say, yep. with the rhythmic composition of the Vanilla Green Miner, the music one.
Yeah.
I want to do that one because I'm really passionate about music, but
okay.
Also there's another reason for that. I knew a guy who was a great guitarist. He was only 3 years younger than me.
Yeah.
But he went through a major psychosis.
Yeah.
Major psychosis. And he was in hospital. But when he was in hospital, his mentality. He noticed light, all these different types of light, and
okay.
A lot of it was blue and purple.
Okay.
And you know how that painting had so much blue and purple
in
it?
Yeah.
And because he was so very creative in his guitar and
music,
it was like that music creeped up on him in a spiritual way. You know, when you mentioned the spiritual essence.
Yeah. And it helped him.
It helped him. It was like that blue and purple saved his life.
Fantastic.
So I wonder if that painting has like some type of element to spirituality.
I'm sure it does.
Yeah.
I'm sure it definitely does.
Yeah.
The colours in there, the shapes, the forms, that was all part of his own Rodemaster's search for some kind of way of harmonising his spirit. Definitely. That's great. Okay, folks. Sorry?
Nature.
That's it.
They made it beautiful. Yeah.
That's right. Catholic University. The Catholic University. ACU.
And you teach literature.
I teach literature, yeah. And this is a group of students who are doing literature through the Clemente program at Mission Australia. Yeah.
Basically, from all this stuff that we saw, we have to pick like one of these projects.
Yes.
And
okay, we're going to move on now, folks. Come this way. It is. Well, you're seeing everything.
going down.
Down, down, down. That's these rooms here, and this, yep. So as you can see, we are scratching the surface of each floor, and there's all sorts of other rooms you can wander in here and get a taste of what contemporary artists are doing with their materials. But this one here stood out for me as another example of showing the links between expression in art as a way of presenting intensity of feeling in the way that we found in the poetry of Galway Kinnell and Judith Wright in particular, or Richard Tipping in his poem The Mangoes, where we were looking at the intensity of language in poetry, which was trying to kind of get the subject off the page into our feelings, into our emotions, into our taste buds almost. And I'll just read you what it says here. This is Dana Schultz. She's an American artist and she produced this in 2015. It's called Breastfeeding. And Dana Schultz once remarked, "I don't think of myself as putting down paint, but as bringing to life whatever it is that I'm painting." I think it's a really good comment about all art forms. Artists are not just putting down words or putting down paint, but they're attempting through their putting down to bring to life whatever it is that they're painting. Here, she paints herself in the process of feeding a body that she literally gave life to. It's called breastfeeding. Filling the canvas from edge to edge with a tangle of limbs, hair and skin, Schutz portrays the act of breastfeeding as a struggle, even a fight. Mother and child grapple so vigorously, they resemble one multi-limbed being. Schutz's massive eye, meeting her son's gaze near the center, is a homage to the cyclops-eyed figures in Philip Guston's late paintings. I don't know who Philip Guston is. That's not a useful comment to me. But certainly when I saw this painting, it certainly gives the impression of this kind of intensity of capturing a visceral, physical experience of mother feeding her child. And it's to do with shapes, it's to do with forms, it's to do with contrasts in colour, the bright greens versus the bright reds, the way that everything pushes out to the edges of the canvas, just like Galway Kinnell's words pushed out to the edge of that sonnet, squelched and squinched and squished.
Onomatopoeia.
Onomatopoeia in colour and form and shape as well as in word. So you can see the kind of linkage between the language of art and the language of literature.
We're gazing at each other's eyes. There's an eye behind an eye.
There is.
I quite like it.
So where's the breast?
That's a good question.
Yeah, there's no breast in it.
You're the rocking chair.
Yeah, I can't see the breast.
Who can see the breast?
Breast.
That's the baby's legs.
I think the breast is obliterated.
Is that the breast there?
No, that's the eye.
She knew everyone would be after the breast, so she...
Oh, no, that's it there. It looks right. Yeah, it looks there.
That's no, that's not it.
That's
an eye meeting an eye, it already says.
That's an eye.
It already says it.
Yeah, and another eye. I'm looking at my child, peering into my child's eye, isn't it, or something?
Yep.
That's what makes you get lost on the breast.
Yeah, with eye obliterated.
With eye breast.
So if that's her eye, there's the breast.
Here she paints herself in the process of feeding a body that she literally gave life to, filling the canvas from edge to edge with a tangle of limbs, hair and skin. Schutz portrays the act of breastfeeding as a struggle, even a fight. Mother and child grapple so vigorously they resemble one multi-limbed being. Schutz's massive eye meeting her son's gaze near the centre.
No, I think maybe
it's just the way the body's laying.
That's it.
Well, I don't think it's meant to be, you know, it's meant, it's sort of, you know, you interpret what it feels like.
It's in there, it's just, that's behind the breast.
Yeah, maybe that's right. Maybe the breast is just behind what we see.
Yes.
Maybe we're seeing all the interaction around the breast, but not the breast itself.
I just wanted to say thank you very much.
Pleasure. Okay, good.
Very nice.
Great. Okay, lovely, good. See you, bye-bye. Thanks for your contributions. Okay, we're going to go down now one floor lower. Let's go down. Down into the Aboriginal section. Ideas interlinking.
Well, there's so much stuff
that's right, absolutely. Are we all here? We're in Boston. Come round this way. So just walk gently around here. There's amazing contemporary art, the vibrations off the wall. Just fantastic. Each of these works you could spend hours in front of thinking about them, connecting with them. But the reason I've come down here really...
They're all dream times, most of them.
They are.
But the it tells a secret to the white settlers of what we know about the land.
But this is what we've come down to see here, specifically.
Oh, yeah.
Now this is by Lynn Onus, and the reason I've selected this one, I've selected it because this is a sculpture, it's not a painting, it's a sculpture, and it's a sculpture that links art with ideas. There it is, it's an object, but it forces the viewer into all sorts of thoughts about interrelationships between cultures, history, all sorts of things come into play with this particular configuration. And Lynn Onus, he's now died. Many of his works were kind of confronting indigenous world with the European colonization. And the first question I want to ask you is, well, Adelaide said, she's the first person who said Hills Hoist, what does a Hills Hoist represent in...
suburbia.
White Australian suburbia.
What about it? Let's have a bit more teasing out some thoughts. Why does it represent a suburban Australia?
Domestic.
A clothesline, domestic. What sort of domestic?
Outback.
Not outback, no. Not outback.
No, sort of working class.
Yeah, working class.
But I would
farm
say...
Farmland.
If you were an Australian living in the suburbs in 1955 and you had a Hills Hoist suddenly put into your back garden, what would you think about yourself? You'd be pretty good. It'd be like having an iPhone 6 in your pocket, wouldn't it?
Or a television.
I mean, a Hills Hoist, my goodness. Not only could the kids swing on it, you could put a sheet over the top of it, and it could be a tent, you could have a party underneath it, barbecue, but you could also hang all your bloody underwear on there and let it dry out within 4 hours, wind it up, wind it down, pull it out, stick it somewhere else. An amazing piece of contemporary technology. So what's Lynn Onus done with it? What has he done with this icon of civilization?
He's shown a different form of domestication.
That's nice. A different form of domestication. What's happened to this hills hoist? It's been taken over by what?
Bats.
What sort of bats? Yeah, what sort of flying foxes? Look, I've never seen flying foxes like that hanging in the Botanic Gardens. Mm-hmm. I've never seen ones like that. What sort of flying foxes?
Black flying foxes.
Have you ever seen a black flying fox with that sort of thing on it there?
Yeah, they're indigenous flying foxes.
Well, that's it.
They're dreaming. Like,
well, there you go. That's it. Sponsored by RL All-Stars. And what's on the ground and what's around here?
That's
one interpretation.
Fruit
is another interpretation. What else?
White people.
They're dropping. Seeds from, what they've eaten have dropped.
But also, like...
It could also be flowers, couldn't they?
Yeah.
And also it seems that, like, because it's on bats, it means this place hasn't been used for quite a while.
It's been unused.
You're not using something, of course bats will come in and use the place.
They're migratory, right? So they migrate with a tree. So one of these bats is the oldest bat, which taught some of the other bats, which are younger, because they stay in a family, right?
Yeah.
So these white settlers come, they knock down that tree and put a hill's hoist in place.
Yeah.
So when they migrate back, what they got?
Okay, so Neil and Josh have had a really interesting discussion there about the historical and realistic causes of such a thing happening. But let's go a step sideways and ask ourselves, what could such a thing symbolise? Instead of talking about the historical and realistic context, what could such a thing like this symbolise?
Destruction of the land.
How could it show destruction of the land, Patricia?
Well, because as Neil said, the trees have gone.
Yeah, but he's talking historically and realistically. What's the symbolic meaning of
unity.
It?
Unity.
What sort of unity?
Well, like making a stand and fighting against the others that...
Who is? Who's fighting against...
The hill's hoist didn't get rid of it,
Adelaide, come a bit closer. Let's have your wisdom in the conversation.
They're trying to reclaim their land.
Yeah, if these are the Aboriginals, and they're coming together to try to fight back the whites, I think.
Take
over.
Nigel, tell us what you think.
They walk hand in hand with each other.
Mine's more, because I think that's shit. So it's like, this is what I think of your hills, always similar to, we come to take back the land. This is what I reckon about the hills.
So you've got this, what's the word? Totemic. You know the word totemic, don't you? The spirit world coming to reclaim the land that's been taken by white Australians, reappropriating the world of the hills hoist, covering it with the totemic spirit. I like the
idea. Stuff here will return into trees.
That's right, fruit bats.
Another perspective I'm seeing is that Western culture is that bats symbolise evil and darkness and stuff like that.
But that's so, in Western culture,
So what about, like,
in the indigenous section?
So if this is indigenous people taking over, then the whites be like, their nightmare. You know what I mean? The whites will see these people these are the nightmares of what I'm interpreting.
These are the nightmares of what's upstairs.
So, like, it's like they're taking over, they're swarming in, what we've done to the Aboriginals.
That's right. So you can see how a work of art, whether it's a painting or a sculpture, can trigger ideas. Art and ideas are very...
Every single one of us could be wrong.
We could. You could all be right as well. He's passed away. But that's the thing about art. Shakespeare's passed away as well. And we're going to be interpreting Shakespeare, trying to understand what he means. That's it. David Malouf, he's here with us. You're going to interpret him, but next week you're going to ask him questions. And you know what he's going to say to you? He's going to say, I haven't read my novel since I've written it. You know more about it than I do. He says that. I have never read my novel since I've written it. I spent 8 years writing it, rewriting it, and I haven't touched it since 1993. You tell me what it's about. So, an artist...
You wrote the book, mate.
That's it. And Lynn Onus produced this.
How do you not know what it's about? You wrote it.
No, it's an interesting question.
It's in the eye of the...
Beholder.
To write so much expression, you must have known what it's about.
Well, that's going to be an interesting discussion next week. Now, let's move down to the greatest
indigenous photographer. This is where we're going to finish now. What time is it? You've got about 20 minutes left to go back and revisit your works, but let's have a quick look down here at Mervyn Bishop. So this is Mervyn Bishop here. You've seen this painting, this photograph. This is an iconic photograph.
It's one of the best photos.
It's amazing, isn't it?
It's unreal. He had me dirt back.
I know, but you know it was done in 1975, and you ask yourself, what's happened since then?
Oh, nothing.
Has the land been given back?
I'm still fighting for it.
So it's a bit of a tragedy, really.
This look like Edward Mabay. You had to get back out and say, right
then. What's his name? Kevin Rudd apologised to the Aboriginals.
He did. But
Kevin Rudd backed up him, and you know, Paul Keating done one down at Redfern Park.
That's right.
Okay. You know what I mean? So there's been a few Prime Ministers in the past that have followed suit.
They should move further than words. Well, this is action, but it needs more than action. It needs more than symbolic action. It needs real action.
It is an act, right.
It's a symbolic act.
It's a very symbolic act, and there's only one other symbolic action that's taken place, which was Kevin Rudd. Paul Keating's was a little bit symbolic, but nothing really eventuated from it because he was out within the next term anyway. But Kevin Rudd, now all school students, this is why they didn't want to say sorry, is because now all school children from kindergarten have to throw out the old history book.
That's right.
We've just got to go ad lib. So here's what happened when Captain Cook came, but Terranalis, it wasn't. So they hear about the word Terra Nullis, but to, you know, like, and it's not to be politically correct for any Indigenous person in the class, it's because of what Australia's history. So then they learn Indigenous history, and the question will come, so how come you said there was nobody here? You know, and that's when kids get to learn, you know, and then it puts a seed in that child's mind, whether they're black or white, to say, that's unfair.
Okay, now, I would like you at this point to rejoin your banana and your pear. All right? To go to your banana or your pear.
So you call me a monkey or something?
No, I'm calling you a monkey.
You're trying to be a bit like David Malouf with just single words, aren't you?
Were you part of a banana, were you?
No.
Go on, where's the other ones? Please join up.
Song. Okay.
Song? Okay. Who else? Where are you now? Do you remember? Adelaide, who are you with?
I'm one of Patricia.
You're Patricia, you're a pear. All right, you're a banana. Well, it's a bit difficult when we've been working all together for the last hour and a half. Now, my suggestion is, please, you to meet on the steps of the gallery at 4:30. So you've got 20 minutes together in your group to revisit the work, each work that you want to have a look at that you're going to do for your blog, and go and talk about it and meet on the steps of the gallery.
So we all have to do the one topic?
No, you don't. You don't. You do three topics. Go on, 1, 2, 3. 1, 2, 1, 2.
No.
Emma wants you all to be on the stairs of the gallery at 4:30 so you can get back to the learning partners. Go for it. We'll see you at the steps at 4:30.
What time is it now?
It's 4:10.
He doesn't know. He wants to send the blog on the same way.
So don't be late.
Pick another piece.
You can pick your own piece from the ones that we've looked at. Because you've got some input on that now. And you've also got the pictures of it too. All right.
Which one did you want to write on?
So where are you three guys going to go? Can I help you? Which ones?
To
the escalator. You haven't got time. You can do that. You can do that before.
I don't have time.
I need to go to the bathroom.
Bathroom.
Yeah.
Bathroom and cigarettes. They're off the menu.
Because everybody's in the block.
Good on you. Go.
You know what I mean.
The song needs some help.
Oh, of course he does. So I'll help some.
Sorry.
He's like me. He's just like, I don't know. I'll have a look at him on the computer and then I'll see what then he can revisit.
But it's different looking on the computer and seeing the real thing in the flesh. A bit like the difference, you know. seeing a flesh and an image.
Sorry, Michael.
Yes.
I think
that
Michael, question. I
want to
ask you something.
Yes.
So,
I
posted a short story on WordPress.
Yes.
But it's a part of a big story that I'm going to make.
Yep.
It's only like, what, 99 words?
Yes.
It's only about 99 words of this art. I got told by one of the students that was being concerned about plagiarism and stuff.
Yep.
So what I've done, I don't know if this is the correct way to do it, I put a little message up the top saying, do not plagiarise this work.
That's all right, you can do that. Creative Commons is what people do. You can get a Creative Commons copyright, but I wouldn't worry about that too much at the moment.
And then
not likely to have anybody copying your stories.
Okay, and then I, instead of posting words